compilation of history in the from the mid 60s forward. Did you read that?
I wasn't at that.
Yeah, okay. So it's an explanation and an explication about just the way he got into cultural studies, and it was the beginning of cultural studies within the discipline of historiography. And he was at Oxford. So he talks about how stuffy it was and how limited. And that's one of the questions that I was thinking of yesterday for you. I have a colleague who is in Celtic studies, which is, you know, really little. But most of the people in that field are in Europe. But he has talked about how limited European academics is. Like, they really want people to focus on one tiny little area, to only study that. So has that limited, is that true, and does that limited an interdisciplinary discourse in Europe as opposed to the United States?
I'm not sure I am competent to speak about European things. That's
water, fine. No ice.
Well, that's fine.
No lemon, no
lemon. No, I've never, other than my time at the center in England, never been at a European university. The European model of a PhD is very different than the American model. And you really, you know, you just go off. I mean, you're accepted to work with a professor, basically, and you go off and you write your dissertation. Usually, I think the expectation is 3 years or something, and then you defend it. And it's I mean, their idea of a defense is much harder than our idea of a defense. That encourages both a kind of hyper-specialization, because it means for 3 years you're only studying what you're writing about. It can also, of course, encourage a certain kind of interdisciplinarity, because you're free to read whatever you want that you think contributes to your subject. I mean, European higher education, my sense is, and it may be just my romanticism of Europe, you know, is that their undergraduate education is much better than ours, in the sense that people are exposed to a range of discourses. Again, it may be changing, but certainly in the past, the people I know, you, as an undergraduate, you would be expected to know philosophy and literature and social theory, et cetera, et cetera, in ways that American education might not. On the other hand, you know, I could see people arguing that the traditions of the university may make innovation more difficult. And it's certainly the case. You know, the people who went to Birmingham to study certainly were people who thought of the traditions of higher education in British universities as kind of narrow, stodgy. You couldn't have done what they were doing at Birmingham at the time in the 70s at most other places. And there is a, when people at Birmingham turned their attention to things like structuralism and post-structuralism, so you've got a book like Dick Hebdige's Subcultures book. What people in America don't understand is that that was a kind of very obvious and public slap in the face to Oxbridge, where semiotics, post-structuralist kind of thinking was taught, but it was taught in a very strictly literary, high literary mode of work. And for, you know, this working class kid from Birmingham, from London at Birmingham, to do this, to claim high theory, and then to claim it in the context of writing about mods and rockers and punks, was, you know, kind of perceived as a kind of debate with the Oxbridge tradition of how these kinds of theories were used. Mm-hmm. Beyond that, I mean, lots of interesting work is done in Europe. I don't really know the answer to that question. You know, part of what you're saying about, I mean, certainly there are many people, I wouldn't say the majority, but certainly my biography, my intellectual biography, while it has its own quirks and idiosyncrasies and specificities, is also partly generational. Mm-hmm. You know, people who were at universities in the 60s and 70s through tumultuous times, if you were fortunate enough to be at one of any number of universities where questions of discipline, questions of the politics of knowledge, questions about the role of students, you know, the relevance of education, et cetera, were raised, where questions of culture were brought in profound ways. Certainly that narrative is a broad one, which pervaded many of the disciplines and gave rise to many intellectual formations, cultural studies being one, but feminist work, you know, critical Marxist work in sociology, critical race theory, all of those formations come out in part of a generational history. So when the conservatives talk about tenured radicals, they're not wrong.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there is something to that, although, you know, it may not always be politically radical. I mean, it's often people who were whose ideas of the intellectual life and what the significance of intellectual work is were radicalized by that experience. Some of them were political radicals, some of them were not, but their view of the university was shaped by that experience. Now, I don't think of history as one discipline where cultural studies has had a profound influence. I mean, there are people in history, certainly, who do cultural studies. There are certainly people in history who have been influenced by it. There are certainly traditions in history, the Radical History Review, socialist historians, labor historians, cultural historians, who were shaped by various forces. Nevertheless, history is one of those disciplines which, while not hostile to cultural studies, has also never been, you know, at the leading edge of participation in cultural studies.
That's one of the points that Ely discusses, that the resistance to accepting a new direction by traditional historians.
And you know, there's a lot of great work. I mean, if you think of the kind of post E.P. Thompson, mm-hmm. you know, work, you think of Catherine Hall's work. I mean, there are many wonderful people doing history, and some of them doing cultural studies in history. But it's a discipline that is steadfastly empiricist in its own way. And, you know, as Hayden White often points out, that is steadfastly anti-theoretical. You know, most historians don't quite see the point of theory. You know, and you would be hard-pressed to name theorists in history. Everyone mentions Hayden White. Name the second. You know, well, you could point to Carolyn Steedman a bit, you know. I mean, there are feminist theorists in history, but, you know, theories of historiography, as it were, you know, have not been the major thrust. Sam Weber's written a little about it, but it's not a discipline that has embraced the theoretical, the cultural theoretical turn, as much as other disciplines. But I could be wrong. I mean, because I don't read, you know, I mean, I'm not by any means, I wouldn't claim to know history as a discipline. I read, you know, I try to read enough to be responsible in terms of the historiographies I draw upon from my own research. And I do think historians are very good at doing, in one sense, what cultural studies wants to do, which is to tell a story about a conjuncture. And that's what historians do. I mean, they're amazing storytellers about what's going on in a particular context. You know, so in that sense, I often tell my students, read, you know, I mean, there's a reason E.P. Thompson will never kind of seen, never saw himself in cultural studies, is nevertheless thought of as one of the founding figures in British cultural studies, and why I have people read works by Carolyn Steedman or Catherine Hall, I mean, who are closer to cultural studies, but also because they're extraordinary contextual thinkers. George Mason has a PhD program in cultural studies in which history is a key component.
I looked into
and there are people, you know, in history, what's his name, who has the book about the 8-hour labor day. There are people in history who connect up to cultural studies in many ways. Michael Denning would be a good example of someone who does kind of history and cultural studies.
How do you see the relationship of interdisciplinarity and cultural studies? You talked a little bit about it yesterday in your lecture.
Well, I mean, I guess I would say cultural studies is of necessity, and I don't often use the phrase of necessity. It is interdisciplinary. Because it is an attempt to think contextually, it is, you know, the other way of saying that, which some people prefer, is to say that it is an attempt to think relationally. And if you think relationally, then you are always drawn beyond the confines of any single discipline. Because you have to, you know, so Stuart Hall has this famous line where he says, if you want to understand culture, the thing you have to do is understand everything that isn't culture. Because you can only understand culture by understanding its relationships to what we would normally think of as the non-cultural. That's a simplification, but as a kind of rhetorical admonition, it works. So I don't know how you could do cultural studies without being interdisciplinary. I don't know how you could do cultural studies inside a single discipline, although there are people, you know, who think you can, and of course many of us are sort of forced into that position. Mm-hmm. But I don't, you know, to think you can do, to think cultural studies is not interdisciplinary in some radical sense is, it seems to me, to conflate cultural studies with a whole set of other very important formations and projects of intellectual work in the world today that are interlocutors, allies, parallel with cultural studies, but that aren't cultural studies. You know, there are people who think cultural studies is, for example, reading anything as if it were a text. So you get people in literature who think if you write about a kind of literary semiotic analysis of shopping malls, then you're doing cultural studies. I mean, as if, so the interdisciplinarity is defined by bringing objects that don't belong in literature into literature. You know, I think that's an interesting project, and I'm all supportive of it, but I just don't think it's cultural studies. Most of the time, I don't go around preaching. You know, it isn't worth the battle to say you're not doing cultural studies and you are, but I do think there is a project of cultural studies which was initiated at Birmingham at one instance, mm-hmm. but was initiated in many other parts, and it's, you know, it was initiated in places in Latin America, in Colombia, in Mexico. Was initiated in India with a certain group of historians. You know, all over the world in the post-war years, I think a number of things came onto people's agendas. Different people shared in different ways. One of them was the recognition of the importance of culture. Right? And of course, for many people, this was the recognition of both the imperialist nature of American culture, which was moving around the world, and that was very important in England, where that was a huge debate. Richard Hoggart's book, The Uses of Literacy, which is one of the founding texts, you know, what was addressed to that debate about the impact of American culture on the British working class. But there was also, you know, the other side of that, which was the nature of native cultures. Hoggart's case, it was not only about the impact of American culture, but what is it you're talking about when you talk about English working class culture? Right? That was true all over the world. Part of it, a second part of it, was the emergence of cultural theory. You know, what's sometimes called the linguistic turn, which, you know, it was initiated earlier. I mean, you could go back to even phenomenology and pragmatism to see some of that. But certainly it's after the Second World War that that term becomes very powerful. And the rediscovery of pragmatism, the discovery of structuralism, the rediscovery of Wittgenstein, etc. So that couples in. The discovery or the concern with the politics of knowledge and the relationship of knowledge to political struggle and the question of the politics of the knowledge you're producing, that comes in as well. All of that shapes, you know, what's going on. But there was one other element that is maybe I should separate them. Two other elements that enter in. One is the recognition of the historical and contextual specificity of the work you do. That's partly a kind of rereading of Marx that comes up, but an argument, it's partly comes out of the anti-colonial movement in the post-war years and the movement for national sovereignty in the colonized world, where people begin to want to argue, about the imperialism of European models of knowledge and the way it destroys indigenous knowledge production. Of course, feminists in their own way raise that argument about the patriarchal dominance of knowledge. And that certainly is crucial for the formation of cultural studies. But I think there's one bit of that contextual thinking that cultural studies makes rather unique, which is to say, not only do we have to think contextually, and cultural studies is one of the formations that I think does that most rigorously and takes that commitment most seriously, so that it is in cultural studies where I tell my students, one of the first questions you get on a job interview is, what's your theoretical position? You're Derridian, you're Foucauldian, you're Deleuzian, you're a Marxist, you're a Donna Haraway-ian, or whatever. And the cultural studies answer is, I don't have a theoretical position, I have a set of theoretical tools. Tell me what the question is, and I'll tell you where I begin. I'll make the gamble that these tools will be the best tools to use.
So how does that approach fit into the contemporary university structure?
Not well.
Departments?
Not well.
question.
That doesn't fit in not just to department structure, but to the way the university operates, which is it assumes people are defined by a set of objects and a set of theoretical and methodological tools. Right? Cultural studies says, well, depending on your object, the theoretical and methodological tools you use will vary. So I wrote a book once called We Gotta Get Out of This Place. And the first draft of that book I wrote assuming that I was going to replicate Stuart Hall's and others, John Clark, Paul Gilroy, Angela McRobbie, and others, attempts to analyze Thatcherism. They had a nice theory built on Gramsci of hegemony. I wrote this book and I reread it and said, this is completely boring. It doesn't tell me anything interesting about what I was trying to write about. The theoretical tools are not up to the context. And I needed to go out and suddenly say, well, I need to supplement, yes, Gramsci, but I needed Lefebvre, I needed a bit of Deleuze, I needed am I a Deleuzian? No, but I use Deleuze. Am I a Lefebvrean? No, but I use Lefebvre. Am I a Gramscian? No, but I use Gramsci. In some cases I use pragmatism. Academics don't like that, and I get in trouble occasionally for telling graduate students that. I had a huge debate in one lecture I gave, where I told graduate students, you want to do cultural studies, what you need to do is have a whole toolbox and not assume that you know the theory in advance. But I think there are other people beyond cultural studies who think that way, although now we're getting closer. But then I think for the most part, the last bit that cultural studies adds is that it thinks that what it's studying is a context, a conjunction. So I heard a brilliant paper I hear brilliant papers all the time in which people take a concrete, well, I'll use an example. I heard a brilliant paper by a friend of mine, not a, I can't claim close friendship, but we are friends, named Homi Bhabha, who's a big post-colonial theorist. And he gave this wonderful, brilliant paper in which he started with Rwanda and the genocide in Rwanda, and then went from the concrete to the universal and philosophized, as it were, theorized the notion of genocide and the possibility of genocide through an analysis of what he called neighborliness. And it was very brilliant. And, you know, I thought, wow, that's good. But that was his analysis, you see. And in the end, I wanted to say, but you haven't told me anything about Rwanda that I didn't know. And for cultural studies, the context, Rwanda, is the object of study, not the abstract concept of genocide or neighborliness. If you, you know, at best, you make what Marx called a detour through theory. So you would theorize genocide, but you would theorize it in order to come back to the concreteness and to tell a better story of Rwanda, just as, you know, you tell a, Hall and others told a better story of what Thatcherism would be. I hope, you know, I told a better story, and we got to get out of this place of the rise of Reaganism and its relation to popular culture. I hope, you know, Caught in the Crossfire began to tell a better story of what was happening to America in the 90s. Because that's its object of study. It's about what we tend to call the cultural studies, or what Hall tends to call the conjuncture, you know, the concrete context. Not because it's the only level of analysis, but because it's a useful level of analysis. Right? I mean, I think one of the dangers is, and maybe I'm guilty of this, you know, people hear my arguments for cultural studies, my defense of it, as an argument that this is the best way to do intellectual work, or this is the only valid. And I don't believe that. I mean, I think there are lots of ways of doing important, good intellectual work, but culture, this is one way, and it's a distinctive way. And, you know, if we start calling everything cultural studies, then we possibly lose the notion that this is one way of doing intellectual work, right? So, you know, I just think it's a particularly, it's a useful way, given the nature of the political struggles these days. It's good to have an understanding of the concrete context that's theorized, that complex, that's interdisciplinary, mm-hmm. right? Because you have to, you know. So what I was trying to say yesterday is, you know, in the end, you can't, I mean, I'm in the midst of writing a paper about the economic crisis in which I look at the derivative. Right? And you know, I spent a year reading in all this stuff in economics on the derivative in order to conclude that there is a reading of the derivative, and it seems to me the best reading, and I can make arguments for that, you know, which connects it up so that you say, you can't understand this economic crisis if you think of it simply as an economic crisis. And yes, you know, Obama, someone will solve the economic crisis, the recession will end, but it's left open, the field of contradiction, struggles, etc., in a way, you know, we're putting a Band-Aid on it without seeing that, you know, America, the United States, if not much of the world, is in a kind of transitional moment. You know, we are struggling from one relatively stable formation in the post-war years to something that we are not sure what it is. The rise of the new right has been an attempt to stabilize, to give a response to the full range of contradictions, economic, political, cultural, and social, that emerged out of the 60s and 70s. Yeah. And it, hopefully, that set of solutions has collapsed. Right? We're waiting to see what the next set of solutions offered will be. You know, and that's how history works. And you only understand that, you know, it seems to me this is a problem with the way the left approaches politics these days, is, you know, we have people there's a name for it, but I can't remember. Where people talk about how there's kind of political overload. So my son, I have a 14-year-old son, he talks about this, you know. So here's the crisis of poverty, and here's the crisis of the environment, and here's the crisis of war, and here's the crisis of nuclear proliferation, and here's the crisis of fundamentalism, and he says, what do I do? You know, if I get involved in this, am I ignoring that? If I get involved in this, am I, you know? And of course, we're not very good at creating alliances because everyone says my crisis is more important than your crisis. You can't solve poverty unless you save the world, but you can't save the world unless you, you know. Well, interestingly, my argument is, of course, those crises are all the same. I mean, they're not the same, but they're all articulated together. They're all part of the conjuncture. And unless you understand the conjuncture and approach it conjuncturally, which the right was much better doing than we were. You know, they understood it is what Hall describes as a hegemonic struggle. You don't just struggle here, you know, over education. You struggle here, you know, you struggle across the full range of contradictions and struggles everywhere. And in each of those struggles, you form different alliances in order to change the world in the direction you want. But the left isn't very good about, you know, saying, what's the nature of the conjunctural struggle? How do we, you know, create a strategy that operates across the realms rather than individually? So, you know, I think that's true of the economic crisis. Yes, you know, you could struggle over the economic crisis, but unless you recognize that it is articulated to militarism, it's articulated to foreign policy, it's articulated to education, it's articulated to religion, it's articulated to healthcare, it's articulated to nuclear proliferation, it's articulated to fundamentalism, you know, and you begin to understand those relationships. You're not going to have a story to tell that works, and you're not going to have a strategy. And if you want to tell that story, you have to be interdisciplinary. And you have to be, what's the adjective? Good interdisciplinary? You have to be, what's the adverb for interdisciplinary? Rigor. I don't like rigor as an adjective, but you have to do it well. And we don't do it very well.
And that seems like it's part of the basic structure of universities today. So does that lead to the conclusion that interdisciplinarity needs to be done outside of the university?
Well,
and how much is that going on now?
It's going on enormously. I mean, some of the most interesting work is going on outside the university. Social movements, especially outside the United States, but to some extent within the United States as well. But if you go to places like Spain and Italy, if you go to Latin America, I mean, think of the Zapatistas, you know, the precariat movement in southern Europe, some of the social movements in Asia that I'm aware of, are producing theory. I mean, these people are reading academic work, but also saying, look, you people aren't giving us what we need, so we're going to do it ourselves, right? And so certainly one of the things we need to do is create conversations with people outside the university. To recognize that the university is no longer the only site of knowledge production in the world. Now that creates a problem because we still have to think why we are privileged. Right? I mean, although we're not the only site, we are no longer the guardians of truth, justice, and whatever, you know. We have to, in a way, legitimate, it seems to me, our own position. People pay me to teach and do research. You know, now there are people out there that I know of who are, you know, working to make a living in where they're not being paid to do intellectual production, but they are doing their labor, their intellectual production, and their political activism. And it seems to me we have an obligation and a responsibility to, you know, enter into conversation, not become service people who, you know, answer their questions, but to, in a way, recognize that the questions we need to ask are questions that the world poses to us and not questions that we pose to us, to ourselves. So I'm a great believer in C. Wright Mills, has this thing in the sociological imagination where he says that when a student asks him what they should write about for their dissertation, his answer is, well, what do you care about in the world when you're not being an academic, and that's what you should write about? I think people need to write about the questions that the world is posing and not the questions that the academy is posing. Okay? Now, I'm all for people doing, I think there are many kinds of intellectuals and many kinds of intellectual work, and I have no objection to the scholar who is writing the 30th book on Shakespeare's tragedy. I think all knowledge is good and we should be supporting it, but I think there is a place for people who think that they have a political responsibility as intellectuals. And if you believe that, then saying, I'm going to do a Derridian analysis of X may not be the way to go about, carrying on a conversation with the world, as it were. So yes, I do think that there is important intellectual production. Artists, cultural workers as well, are part of that conversation, and the university is not set up to have that conversation, to foster it, to provide a home for it. But the university is in its current form an institution that was created at a certain moment in time to answer the needs of a certain conjuncture, a certain social reality, when a certain set of priorities, values, etc. When the university was set up with, at the moment of the rise of expertise, notions of science, etc., etc. When there was an explosion in knowledge production, and it was set up in a certain way. Johns Hopkins imports a certain understanding of the Germanic university, creates the contemporary structure. Chicago takes it up, it gets disseminated, and we're living in it. And it is, like all other institutions in our society, it is going through a kind of crisis. It's going through many crises. And one of them is certainly the challenge of interdisciplinarity. Every major foundation, every major study of the university and its future says it's got to find a way to do interdisciplinarity, and no one knows how to do it. Everyone says there is already a kind of horizontal university that coexists alongside the silos, disciplines, schools, colleges. People do interdisciplinary work. There was a recent study a few years ago in which some foundation asked scholars who their primary interlocutors were. That is, if when you do your write a paper, to whom do you send your paper? And what they found was it was no longer disciplinary. People's intellectual networks are no longer disciplinary. They're interdisciplinary, but the institution is disciplinary. There has to be a way to institutionalize it without forcing it into the vertical, rigid silos again. That's the problem. How do you imagine a flexible, networked institution? But of course, many institutions are trying to figure this out, not just the university. And there's enormous resistance to it, obviously, because the majority of scholars and the entire infrastructure of the university is organized vertically. You come to people and you say, you're going to change. Resources are going to be redistributed. Forms of authority, knowledge, and decision-making are going to be redistributed. People are often very reluctant to do that.
And currently today, I think a lot of universities are going through restructurings of budget cuts and so forth. And so what does this mean? You mentioned earlier a really interesting point about the connection of the expert or expertise with this kind of Euro-modernity. So if we're moving away from trying to be experts, what direction is this going in?
Well, I want to be careful. I don't know that I want to move away from being experts, but I want to move away from a particular model of what it means to be an expert, or at least I want to pluralize it. I mean, it's very useful to have geneticists who understand X. It's very useful to have economists who study the economics of welfare. You know, I need them. You know, I need people writing about the finance market. But we need to proliferate the models of how to be an expert, of how to be an intellectual, of how to be an academic. And that's really the problem. The problem is monocultural notions. Richard Hoggart, who was the founder of the center, used to fondly quote William Blake, "May God us keep from single thinking and Newton's sleep," something like that. I'm getting it wrong. It's in my manuscript.
It's in your manuscript.
Yes.
Yeah.
That is, protect us from thinking that there's one way of thinking. You know, and I don't want to argue that interdisciplinarity is the only way to think. You know, I just want to say it should be given authority alongside and in conversation with these other ways of thinking, and oddly enough, one of the responses to the kind of crisis of expertise, whereby, for any number of reasons, including a tradition of anti-intellectualism in America, but the rise of the right and its challenge of the domination of secular liberal humanistic models of intellectual life, and the contribution of the left in terms of a kind of relativist sounding discourse, standpoint theory, social construction of reality, etc. One of the responses to that has been the resurgence of science and the authority of science. So we're finding, evolutionary genetics now is offering itself, as is economics, as the solution to all our problems, right? Because these are the rigorous scientific theories. And you see it in popular discourse. You see all these stories about, how evolution can explain X, or how freakonomics, how market models can explain why people get married and divorced and shit. And you just want to say, come on, give me a break. I mean, the fact that you can show statistically correlations does not offer an explanation. We knew that 50 years ago. Why have we forgotten that correlation isn't causality? And so that's one of the paths that has been taken, and part of it is also, and not unrelated to that, is a backlash against interdisciplinarity. You're seeing disciplines reclaim their boundaries against interdisciplinarity, and you're seeing disciplines, and I'm hearing this all the time, who want to say you can be interdisciplinary inside the discipline, like all these professors of English, anthropology, etc., who think they're already interdisciplinary because they read occasionally, mainly theory. Mainly what they read outside their discipline is literary theory or communication theory, or they read Hall on Thatcherism, and it's the end where they read Gramsci. So you're seeing a backlash against interdisciplinarity, and the budget cuts are often, I'm hearing stories, I'm hearing here too, budget cuts are a good excuse to chop interdisciplinary programs, which are inefficient because they're high labor, small productivity, because there's a huge startup time for interdisciplinarity. doesn't come quickly. Interdisciplinary conversations take a, as I was saying yesterday with my octopus friend, right? It takes a long time to have that interdisciplinary conversation. So when I'm in conversations with these a few economists, what we have to do is I send them my work, they send me their work, we read it, we get back and say, I don't understand this. Are you claiming this? If I read this way, is this right? What do you mean by this? Maybe I can give me something to read. Over a course of a year or so, I've got this one guy in Australia, and we're starting to understand each other. He's starting to understand why I'm reading this way. I'm understanding what he's doing, et cetera, et cetera. It's very inefficient. It is very high cost for a university, from a university's perspective. And it does not feed into the academic market. Worry about jobs.
Just bottom line.
The irony, of course, is if you go to business, businesses are all about now interdisciplinarity. I read The Economist, so it's good to read what the capitalists think. And, every once in a while they have their inside cover is this big thing with a whole bunch of smokestack silos, and they're all crossed out, and it says, think outside the silos. And, it's the Chamber of Commerce or something, I mean, business understands that people have to learn to think problem-solving, not disciplinary. They don't need people who think within a discipline. They need people who think, here's a problem, and I know, I will get whatever resources I need to answer the question.
But is that sort of paying lip service to it? Because what they ultimately want is the bottom line protected. So think outside the box,
yes,
as long as you make the profit.
Well,
so
of course.
Isn't that contradictory?
Of course, but it's a discourse we should be able to use. Mm-hmm. We should be able to mount that and say, the kind of people they want to hire are the people who can know how to solve problems, not the people who know the discipline of sociology or accounting or something. Skills learnings are easy. They want people who are problem solvers, which, is what interdisciplinary thinking always is. I have a problem, where do I go to solve the problem? Partly the responsibility is ours because we have not yet found the best models, we're still in an experimental stage. I mean, this program is getting lots of people are talking about it because it is a model, it's an experiment. We're looking at it, that's interesting. I wonder if that's going to work. Maybe we should do that. There are other models out there people are looking at. This model, there are questions at every level of administration. How you do this, and of course, at every level, there's always resistance, and the budget cuts make the resistance even stronger. So, I'm optimistic in the long run. I'm optimistic in the long run. I think universities are going to change. My feeling is either they will change in ways that we direct, or they will change in ways that corporate bureaucratic capitalists and governments make them change. I hope they change in the ways we academics think they should change. But if not, they'll change in other ways. But they're institutions. They have histories. And they may like to pretend they don't have histories, but they do. And they respond to pressures. They have no choice.
What kind of pressures? What can we as academics? We're facing some huge challenges in all universities, I guess. The attack on humanities, the attack on liberal arts. I mean, I feel like we in humanities are just besieged already.
We're asked to justify ourselves.
Yeah, justify. Why is it important? This writing that Stanley Fish is doing is really intriguing to me.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people are reading it.
Yeah.
It's a big forum. So how do we, assert any kind of power over this decision-making process that seems to be wholly based on numbers. And maybe I'm wrong, but that's the appearance right now.
Well, let's not be more pessimistic than we need to be. I mean, universities are under enormous pressure for accountability, et cetera, efficiency, et cetera, et cetera, and to some extent are doing it and responding to it, but not entirely. Universities are also resisting it, offering counter proposals. I mean, these are fields of negotiation which are pushing slowly, although pushing in directions that are not good. I mean, although, I think we have to respond in a number of ways, one of which is to recognize that some of these changes. We have to understand what's going on and recognize that you don't change the world by saying we wish we were here. You change the world by saying this is where we are, let's take this step in that direction, and I have to bring people along with it. So, despite my Marxist upbringing or education, we are not going to overthrow capitalism. Mm-hmm. Today or tomorrow. Right. So, and I'm not a great believer that what we should do is somewhere behind, in secret, organize for the revolution and wait for it to happen. I'm a great believer that you analyze what's going on in capitalism and you try to change it in ways that are better. Mm-hmm. Right? And in order to do that, you have to speak to people where they are, what their fears and hopes and desires are. And we are not very good at doing that. Right? So the right was very good at saying to people, the market is good. People believe the market is good. I believe the market is good. I may not believe that in the long run it's the best system. But over, from my grandfather to my father to my life, the market has been good to us. And has been good to many people, especially in American society. So you can't. Now, most people also don't believe that everything should be a market, and I don't believe we have ever lived in this vision, this nightmare vision that some leftists write about, in which everything has become market value and exchange value and money. People hold on to their values. The proof is, people believe in certain kinds of religious values. No one believes that everything is exchange value and money value, but the right was able to say to people, overall you think the market is good, and a lot of your hopes and desires are that your children can afford to live a life better than yours, so let's build on that hope and dream and faith and value of the market to get people to move where we want them to move, even though in the end it may not be where people would have chosen to move. We are not very good at doing that. Right, of understanding where people are and then trying to move them in the direction we want. We are also not very good at, as you said, telling people why certain values are important. So I have a friend, John Clark, who's a cultural studies figure in England who writes about welfare and governance. And he has argued that, the left has to bear some of the responsibility for the destruction of welfare in America. Why? Because it never bothered to tell people when Reagan and Clinton were fighting against welfare. It never bothered to remind people why welfare was put in place. It never bothered to remind people that their grandparents fought for welfare. Right? It never reminded people that their grandparents died to have unions in America. Right? It never reminded people of why these things mattered and of the history of struggle to create them. That might have led people to think, oh yes, these things do happen. And people did sacrifice their time, their effort, their money, their lives to protect future generations. Are we now going to abandon that? Now some people are worried about welfare again because in part because we didn't engage in the popular public debate over welfare, except to say, oh, you terrible people are going to eliminate welfare. We're partly responsible for that. Now, come to the humanities. we act as though it's intrinsically obvious to everyone why what we do is important. Now, you know, people out there see us and they say, you people, you know, you spend 6 or 9 hours a week working, and you do this obscure stuff, writing about God knows what, or ranting against America. You know, what? Why should we pay, you know, for you to do this? Why does this matter? Why do we want our children to take these classes? And we haven't sat down, you know, and said, now Stanley is one person who at least does it. I don't always agree with what he argues, but he at least does occasionally try to tell people why what we do matters. But we're terrible at it, you know. I mean, why should they just take on our word that what we do matters? And why, I mean, I do believe, I'm getting a lot of trouble, it's in the book, you know. I do believe that we have gone too far in politicizing intellectual work. That is, you know, I'll tell you a story. When I wrote We Gotta Get Out of This Place, it turned out that there was an order for the book. I got a call from the publisher. The book was ordered as a textbook at a religious, you know, like a fundamentalist university. And, you know, usually if a book is ordered at a university, you can call someone up at the university and say, this is great, what are you using it for? I don't know anyone. No one I knew anyone teaching at these places.
Liberty University.
I called Stuart Hall up, who was my mentor and one of my two people that have shaped me, Stuart Hall and James Carey. And I called Stuart and I said, what do I do? And he said, well, look, you have to assume that what this means is that there's something about your book that they think is right. Now, they may be using it in ways you don't want them to, but he said, look, you know, if cultural studies, if lots of people have argued that the way culture works is people find what they want, you know, they find surprising things in culture and they use them in surprising ways. Why are you surprised that they can do this with intellectual culture? But he also said, you know, the point of your analysis is to come up with the best story you can of what's going on. The best story you can, while it may be, you think, shaped by your political investments, and to some extent it obviously is, but the better story is always a story that has multiple possible implications, and therefore it can be articulated to the right or the left. Trying to protect the story we tell so that only a politically correct left winger would ever want to read what we write or could ever think that we are right seems to me bad intellectual work. You know, if you're trying to tell a story, I do believe in some kind of, and you know, I do try to do it in the book, I do believe in some kind of empirical reality. And I do believe that we have an obligation to that empirical reality, and we don't just get to say, I get to interpret the world the way my politics wants to interpret it, and fuck you, if you don't like it. I think, you know, the population has a right to say, why am I paying you to rant about your politics? Well, you're not. You're paying me to understand the world better, because a better understanding of the world opens up possibilities. You don't have to follow. I would like you to take my story and go that way. But I could see right-wingers taking my story and using it to go their way, too. And that's good, in one sense, because it means I've told a better story. Right? You know, I think we have confused the political nature of knowledge with the substitution of politics for knowledge. Right? So, you know, I think we need to come back to people and say, we do have a function, we do have an important purpose, and we do, the humanities do contribute something, and they are important in education, and we can't just leave it, you know, to the obvious, that is, so we teach ethics. Well, great, so they'll fire everyone except the ethics professor, you know, or we'll all become little mini ethicists who go around. You know, I don't want to teach ethics. I don't think it's my job to teach ethics or to make my students ethical people. I think it's my job to give students tools which will enable them to understand what's going on in the world and how their lives fits into it and how to see the possibilities of what's going on to change the world, right? You know, and there are people we could turn to. Dewey was wonderful, for example, in explaining how knowledge impacted the world, you know. But we just don't do it, you know, and I think we need to do it. We need to explain to people that theoretically sophisticated analyses which are non-communicative to ordinary citizens may not therefore be bad. You know, I mean, I often use the example that you don't really want your auto mechanic telling you that the thingamajig is broken. You want your auto mechanic to sound completely obfuscating. Right?
Jargon, you know, is good.
Yeah, because that's, you know, and you want your doctor to have some jargon. Right? But you also want someone to be able to translate. Exactly. And the other thing we don't do is produce popularizers. You know, I've long been an advocate of there. You know, there's a whole field of you can study how to be a science journalist. You can study how to be a business journalist, but we don't train people to be human science journalists. Right? We don't train them to explain to the world why Derrida was a revolution, and I mean explain in the pages of Newsweek, CNN. John Stewart, you know, explaining that actually, you know, understanding that language always fails, you know, being able to mount examples, you know, being able to explain to people why understanding the nature of discursive apparatuses and the ways discourses articulate, connect, and produce reality enables us to understand the world more productively and to act in the world more productively and to think about the world more productively, to be better citizens. You know, the way in which feminism has improved people's lives and the way in which, although they may not, they don't have to understand, but the way in which reading Kristeva or Ira Garay or Donna Haraway enables people to go into a classroom and help people understand the nature of interpersonal relations, the nature of institutions better. You know, now, you know, are we, do academics have to do it? Well, if we don't want to do it, you know, someone like Stanley can do it, Skip Gates does it. You know, but on the other hand, most scientists are not very good at explaining what they do to the world, but they have some scientists who are. And they train journalists who can do that. You know? We sort of think all of our best students should always become our little mini replicants. Right? Instead of saying to our best students, you know, really, I want you to go and take some journalism classes. I want you to actually learn how to write. You know, I want you to study common sense so that you can find a way to bridge that gap. We just don't think of that. We don't think it's our responsibility.
So where is the conjuncture between the discourses of humanities and interdisciplinary and economics and business when there's such polarity right now? And it seems to me as an observer that our American culture is degenerated into this 30-second soundbite. Up to the very highest level, we all want to label, we want easy answers, we want it to be straightforward. And when you talk about interdisciplinary studies, you're talking about real work. And you said that yesterday, in real discourse that takes time. How do we get back to that in the general conversation? Or can we?
By remembering that the world is always changing. And how it changes is the non-predictable result of, but in part, of what we do in the world. Now, yes, the split, the gap between economics as a model of society and life and culture, the humanities, has grown, both in the sense that the distance between them over the past 30 years has grown. Used to have economists like Keynes or John Kenneth Galbraith, who were very different from what we have today. And you used to have humanities people who, could speak across that gap. And at the same time, we've had a political formation that has tried to impose that business economic discourse on culture, and to a large extent succeeded. But this is a change in history, and history keeps changing. And it's a question of what we do. So I like to remind people that in the 1960s and 70s, the leading spokesperson for finance capital in America, leading political representation of finance capital in America, was Nelson Rockefeller, who by contemporary standards looks like a socialist. He called for national health care, pro-welfare, etc. This was finance capital speaking, and they believed that that was the best politics for their interests, right? Because the interests of finance capital are not guaranteed by finance capital. They're an articulation. What happened? Well, a coalition of political forces decided to convince finance capitalists that that was not the right politics for them, that this was. And they decided to convince journalists. Remember that. You won't remember. But in 1964, Barry Goldwater ran on basically the same economic platform that Ronald Reagan and then G.W. Bush ran on. And the Wall Street Journal described Barry Goldwater's economic policy as suicide for America. Right? 16 years later, they endorsed the same economic policy for Ronald Reagan. Why? Had the world changed? Had the nature of markets changed? No, because people did the work of going to those journalists and of educating journalists and of going into journalism schools and teaching the courses and teaching economics so that people's minds were changed. Right? Just as, what we've seen is transformations of the industry, the cultural industries, by which they have been brought to the same economic logics as other corporations. But there were capitalists, very wealthy, powerful capitalists who invested in cultural industries, not because they thought they were huge profit-making ventures, but because they were significant contributions to the civilization of the world they were making, right? And, whether you look at the early film magnates or Walt Disney, I'm not a great fan of Walt Disney's politics, but nevertheless, you look even at Ted Turner when he starts. These people were willing to say that these are complex systems of value, right? The changes by which we have made corporations so short-term, so that the increasing responsibility of CEOs over managers, the investment of CEOs in by which we pay them through stock options so that they have to worry about the cost. All these changes were not inevitable. They were brought about by people making arguments, educating other people, doing institutional work, etc., etc. And they changed the world. So, if you want to change the world, you're going to have to do the work. You don't just get to sort of scream out that this is wrong. You get to do the work by going back to the journalists and saying, now wait a minute, you've been saying this for 20 years, and look where it's gotten us. Don't you think maybe it's time to rethink your economics? We need to go into the J schools, into the law schools, into, you know, the economics departments. And we need to do all this work. We need to engage with the public. We need to really, you know, I have friends who are very much involved in the struggles over media regulation, and there's a huge movement, you know, which I think is great. We need to remind people that there is a reason that the media were at one point protected from the ravages of culture. There is a reason that, you know, in many parts of the world, the media are still protected. Now, you know, but part of that means not only making the arguments, it's inventing new solutions. I mean, part of the irony is we now find ourselves defending Keynesianism. In the 60s, we were attacking Keynesian. Keynesianism is paternalistic, it's often racist, it's often, imperialist. It has lots of problems, but we're now defending old-fashioned Keynesian liberalism instead of saying, or, you know, communism. Capitalism sucks, and we're just waiting for it to be overthrown. Instead of doing the difficult work, which is, well, what would it? Can we just imagine two steps, three steps out from where we are? What's a better system? Right. So, you know, Americans won't ever agree to nationalize the media industries. You know, BBC, they'll never agree to that. Right? But are there not forms of organization, control, economies of media that we could imagine that begin to address these questions? Can we not, if governments are guaranteeing banks' profits, could you not imagine a government that guaranteed media profits, you know, for at least some? Now, if not every one of the 4,000 cable TV stations, you know, at least then, but we should have some stations that don't have to worry about this. Not because we're going to tell them what quality TV is, but because we want them open to, you know, conversation with cultural workers, that they can produce things that don't have to worry about. You know? And what's amazing about the media, for me, is not how bad it's become, but how, given how bad it's become, how much good stuff there is on the media. So can we not figure out why that's happening? Just as when I teach media studies, I never ask my students, I tell my students they can't write a paper that tells me how racist Hollywood movies are. They have to write a paper that tells me where there's a Hollywood movie that isn't racist and tell me how that got made, given the racist system. So, you know, how does Jon Stewart get on the air? How does Heroes get on the air? How does Battlestar Galactica get on the air? I mean, there's enormous quality TV. There's enormous quality film. There's enormous quality rock and roll being made. And we're saying, oh, the industry has become totally capitalist, and I want to know how the Decemberists are getting produced. Airborne Toxic Event is getting produced and becoming popular. Yeah? There's incredible good stuff being produced. So let's figure out how that's working and try to just change the system a little more so it's a little easier, you know, and move that step. Take it to the public. Go to the media people. Go to Ted Turner. Go to these people and say, look, which is more important to you? You can, you know, retire with $1 billion, or you can retire in ways that you will be remembered for 100 years, in the ways that those founders of Hollywood are remembered, right? As people who made a significant, which is the legacy you want to leave. You really want your children to, you know, think of you or your grandchildren as the person who made $1 billion, or do you want them to think of you as the person who reinvented television? Mm-hmm. And I just think, you know, there are arguments, changes, but we don't, I don't think we do enough of that. Think imaginatively, and also think analytically. What is going on? What do people believe? What do people want? You know, people are very upset about the marketization of everything. People are upset about what's happening to education. And, you know, if all we can tell them is, well, let's go back to the 1950s. You know, that's not a very compelling idea. And if all we can do is rant about how capitalism is destroying the world, that's not very compelling either. So where's the analysis? I mean, it's surprising how little. I mean, if I were to ask you to name 10 books that are brilliant analyses of the United States in the past 25 years, besides mine, what would you name? You know, I would name, for example, Fukuyama.
I haven't read that.
You know, not so much the end of liberalism or whatever, the last man, but the Great Disruption, which is about the 70s, I think is a brilliant conjunctural cultural studies analysis from the right of what's going on. But it's surprising how few of those books there are. You could begin to say, well, maybe that book looks at the changing nature of corporations or something. But, you know, it seems to me that that's a horrible, horrible statement to make, that we can't name books that we would think are vital books to give to people so that they could have a better understanding of society. I would give them Fukuyama, and I would give them Caught in the Crossfire. You know, I could probably, if I sat down, think of a few others, but, you know, not that many. Now, you know, I mean, come back to it, you need disciplines. I mean, John Clark, who is like my brother, he has this great thing where he says, you know, look, I'm an unusual person, he says, or maybe cultural studies is unusual, because he says, I don't really do any research. I don't know anything. What I do is take the research from all these disciplines, and I figure out what happens when you put the findings from here, 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 and here together, and you interpret them in the light of one another, and you begin to see the relations, and you tell a story about the whole thing. Where are the stories about the whole thing? Right, which is what you want. I mean, that's what I tried to do with Caught in the Crossfire. And I tried to write it, you know, so that people could read it, although no one bought it, so it was a bit of a failure in the end. Okay. But, you know, that's partly my fault and partly because I hadn't figured out how the book industry works enough to, you know, figure out how to get a book into that field where actually it might get reviewed. So, we haven't answered any of your questions.
No. We're touching on several of them.
Yes.
How do you, it's back to cultural study, pop culture, modern culture, and the arts and entertainment, you brought up the Decemberists, who I just love. And the change, I mean, do we want Ted Turner in this discourse when what we're seeing now is, I look at Focus Films, for example, I love Focus Films, that studio is just huge now. Huge success, and it's sort of individual startup, and artists who are recording, creating their own labels to record their music, so they're not, you know, restricted by the major labels, and so we're seeing a whole counter revolution that's producing wonderful stuff. So how do you? And that probably, I don't know if that's been written about just yet, but it's probably the time we're seeing successes of people who are taking back the production part of their art. And well, the internet has a huge impact on that.
Yes.
So is that one of the biggest benefits of the internet and digital technology where we can produce now? So
sure. It is a whole set. It opens up a whole set of possibilities. The nature of the possibilities of production and of communication with the public have closed down here and opened up here. So between digital production, you know, you can take GarageBand and you can make music that is extraordinary. Yeah, the production values you can make, you know, with an Apple, you can my 14-year-old son and his best friend make movies and post them on YouTube, and you know they get 5 stars. I mean, the production value, that's great. And it's crucial, and some of those people have success. And we need to fight for that, you know. I mean, Warner Brothers is going after YouTube, you know, and YouTube, you know, there was just a story about some girl who's made a movie using Warner Brothers music, and it ended up getting taken down because YouTube's way of searching doesn't distinguish between amateurs and professionals. You know? So we need to fight to keep that internet open, you know, which is a big fight. But at the same time, it proposes, it opens up a new problem, which is the explosion and proliferation of cultural production is on the one hand good, but on the other hand creates a universe of fragmentation, right? And that bad side, if you will, that corporate side of the media still controls the public discourse of the media. So when I go into my classes and I talk about how I've just heard, you know, Airborne Toxic expressed on YouTube, I don't know that my students have heard it. But actually they have now, because Airborne Toxic Express has been one of the success stories, right? You know, we can't fall prey to the too easy political decision of saying, well, the internet's going to democratize the world and make television, cable, Hollywood film production and the music industry irrelevant. It isn't, right? So we still need to both protect the internet and ask how we're going to either reform that, or how we're going to bring the two together in productive ways. We still need to imagine the realm of public discourse, because we, if nothing else, we need it politically. We need to have, you know, the ability to speak across constituencies. Right? We need the ability to speak to a public, to a commons. You know? And I do believe that. I also believe that, you know, there's a very classic article that my teacher, James Carey, co-wrote a long time ago called The History of the Future. And what it argues is that every new technology that has been every new communication technology that has been introduced since the telegraph has been greeted with the exact same two discourses. One is the discourse of this is the salvation of the world, and the other is this is the end of the world, right? That's true of the telegraph, it was true of comic books, it was true of film, it was true of radio, it was true of television, it was true of now the internet. You see the same thing. And of course the answer, if you look at all these, is neither discourse is true. Because what happens is they negotiate between those features that the people who think it's the end of the world rightly see, and those people who think it's the salvation of the world. So people don't talk about the fact that, you know, when I was in public school in the 50s, New York City made this huge investment in television. They had this idea that putting a TV set in every classroom was going to revolutionize education, democratize it, improve, you know. Of course, what happened was, didn't. The same is happening with computers now. You know, as if every student has access to a computer, then somehow it's going to be the salvation of public education. It isn't. Right? We need to see that the new internet technologies are wonderful. They're going to have profound implications for the world, but they aren't going to save the world and they aren't going to destroy it. Right? And they're going to negotiate, right? In between that corporate media world and that internet anarchist world, there's going to be new formations of media coming out. And we're either involved in that conversation in terms of inventing the future from an understanding of what's happening, or we're not. You know, we can critique them and we can talk about how wonderful this is, in which case, I don't think we're involved in that conversation of trying to help imagine what the future of this is going to be. You know, the internet's going to collapse if it keeps going. And there are already people who are saying Internet 2 is going to collapse even faster because they're not imagining, you know, what this can do, you know, between the saturation. As people start downloading movies on a regular daily basis, I can download a movie onto my iPhone now.
I mean,
what is that, you know, the amount of data that this is demanding? And then, of course, the sophistication of hackers. I mean, this new virus that's going around, you know. I mean, what happens in the world if people bring down the Internet? You know, I mean, all this cloud computing stuff means what? That when the Internet goes down, you have no access to anything. I'm not being nightmarish or being utopian here. I'm just saying, you know, these things are much more complicated. They're involved with economic, political, cultural, you know, in complex ways. We need to be engaged. And there are some people in a variety of ways, but we need more of it. But there is great stuff being produced on the Internet. But there's great stuff, as I said, being produced in mainstream media.
It's
quite amazing. Mm-hmm. You know, there's probably, you know, you can't really measure because there's so many more access channels. So to say there's more quality TV now than ever before, but yes, because there are now 400 stations. So if you get enough monkeys typing away in the typewriters, you're bound to produce more quality stuff. Okay, what else is on the list?
Well, I think we're probably just about out of time.
Well, I'm not. Keep going.
Well,
Wolfgang's
not
here.
Yeah, I think he said about 12, 10.
Well,
yeah.
And any of these seem crucial to you?
I would be interested if you could speak for a minute about some of the discourse in cultural economics, where you do have a very strong, and the majority of it would be in the neoclassical model, but then you do have a few outliers. I'm thinking of Ariel Klammer, I'm thinking of, if you quite call him an economist, David Thoresby.
Mm-hmm.
How do you see that in relation to your current project on cultural studies? And looking at the
I am reading them.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not... I don't find them as helpful. There's a whole movement now, cultural economy, and there is a journal of the Journal of Cultural Economy, which is mainly a coalition, as far as I can tell, between some of the kind of people you've mentioned, Crosby, and some people who come out of cultural studies, like Paul DeGay, Mike Pryke, and some people who come out of Latourian studies, science studies. And I'm on the board of this journal, and I was at the sort of one of the founding meetings. And I find it interesting. I think that they... the chapter in economics talks about it. I find their work oddly, and this is true generally of Latourians, although surprisingly it is true of the sort of cultural studies people doing this. I find their work oddly depoliticized. In general, Latourian type work, assembly, whatever they call it, just blanking on it, I find very hyper empiricist and very depoliticized. And I find that they often take the category of the economic for granted, rather than contextualize it. So what much of this work is about are the, you know, they do, there's a lot of very interesting, again, it's very interesting and important stuff. You know, it's a kind of anthropology of the practices of various kinds of people in the economic sector. So there's a lot of work now on, you know, what finance people actually do in these things. And there's lots of work on what you might call the social construction of the market. You know, Calonne, who's a major kind of student of Latour, who writes about economics, you know, his stuff is on the social construction of the market. And I think that's important work. It's about how discourse constructs the market. As I tried to suggest last night, you know, I think that's only a bit of the puzzle that we need to do, and doesn't go far enough to understand that the very notion of the economy itself is constructed, and that the construction is not only discursive but is material and contextual and political as well. Mm-hmm. So I think the stuff in cultural economy broadly is an important step forward. One is in that, I'm in that awkward position of both wanting to say I like it, it's important, I'm part of that movement, I support it, but I also think it has serious limitations in the way it's practiced, and I don't want to construct myself as an opponent of it or as only a critic of it, but as someone who wants to say yes, but the conversation has to be broadened, it has to be deepened, and has to be made more critical.
And in a little bit earlier movement that was kind of connected, like the rhetoric of economics.
Yes.
McCloskey. That's kind of the, but that really died out, I think, towards the end of the
90s. She's still around.
Sure, sure.
She's got it's a good book on statistics, on the rhetoric, the way in which the statistics serves as a rhetorical device for establishing economic authority and the power of statistics. You know, again, I think it's useful work, but the interesting thing, of course, is Deirdre McCloskey is basically a neoclassical economist.
Yeah,
there's nothing about her work that, for her, calls into question the validity of economics or the validity of neoclassical economics, right? She is just describing, and it's important, the way in which economics uses rhetoric to establish its authority. But she perfectly well believes that it deserves that authority and that these rhetorical devices are perfectly appropriate. You know, so again, I mean, I want to say, you know, that's a bit. I mean, then that work is good, and you know, one needs to read it and take it seriously and then recognize that its implications are limited until you begin to put the pieces together. Right? It's like, you know, holding up. I use the analogy for cultural studies quite often. If you want to know what doing cultural studies work is like, imagine someone has dumped 10 of these gigantic 1,000-piece jigsaw puzzles, you know, that spread out on a table. And so imagine someone has taken 10 of these puzzles and they've dumped them into a box and they've thrown away the covers. Right? So you pull out a piece and you have no idea what it is. I mean, it's blue. It could be the sky, it could be the ocean, it could be a bit of a car, it could be a bit of blue dress, it could be anything. Right? You put it down. You have no idea what it is until you start to take out other pieces. Some pieces you throw away because you say, I can't, you know, they don't, whatever I'm constructing here, this piece doesn't seem to be a bit of it. Right? You could be wrong and have to go back and get it. But that's what cultural studies work is like for me. Right? So, yes, the rhetoric, what Deirdre does, is crucial. It's a piece there, but she doesn't really, you know, what she wants to do with it is, what she wants to do with it is just the opposite of what I want to do with it. I want to make it do some work that you would never imagine. So I'm going to put it down in my puzzle over here, where she puts it down in a different puzzle over here to legitimate neoclassical theory. I'm going to put it down here so it helps us understand how the authority is being constructed in ways that we need to contest.
Hey.
Hey.
If there's lunch to be had, we've got to have it.
Yeah.
Sorry.